So after these many weeks of context, we come to the question before us, what shall we do? Or as the subtitle of the lesson asks, how shall we be Christian? What is our Christian response to this moment in history? Now, a recurring refrain through the whole lesson has been this, that when a moment's time has come, when circumstances, when the divine, when righteousness, when goodness will no longer allow us to turn a blind eye, with wounds long ignored, can no longer be ignored, what shall we do? How shall we be Christian? Well, in a word, what we do is this. We go to work on our Christian mandate for oneness. The acknowledgement that everything is connected. The acknowledgement that there is no other. That we are all part of a connected whole. We go to work on that. If any truth from our ancient tradition has informed our own community's spiritual journey, it's that one. You hear it all the time. I'll say, oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness. You'll hear me say all the time, everything is connected. Our call as Christians is to work for the good of the whole, not just the good of the part that we happen to find ourselves in. Now, it is true that two-ness feels very real to us. I say it all the time, because I can move my arm, but I can't move your arm. I naturally intuit that I am one and you are two. However, the wisdom of our tradition insists, as does the wisdom of our physicists that I've kind of expounded on at length, that as real as two-ness feels, it is not the most accurate description of reality. And when we function in reality as reality is not, inevitably it's going to go badly for us. I believe that what's going badly for us right now as a society is that we are functioning in a reality of two-ness that is not reality. Now, in the past, we've explored what Jesus and what Paul and what our traditions, saints and sages, have taught us about the way of oneness. That is a particularly important truth to understand now in this historical moment, because when our society's systems put white people in one category and people of color in another category, when the invisible social systems that we've been exploring in this lesson are such that they keep those there, we can be fooled a while into believing that's the way it is. But as long as oneness is a truer truth, no matter how sincere our beliefs, no matter how many data points seem to confirm our story, we will suffer the inevitable consequences of living in a world as the world is not. So what shall we do? As Christians, in a world that is steeped in a persistent illusion of two-ness, what shall we do? We work creating a oneness reality. Now, I mentioned last week that the principles and practices that we apply to be a healthy spiritual community are the same principle and practices, albeit in a much more demanding environment. They're the same principles and practices that apply when we work for oneness in a racially divided nation. We're just starting this year's conflict resolution group. And every time we do that training, we see it in a very rubber meets the road kind of way, how oneness really is a truer than our two-ness illusion. Once we understand the thing under the thing in ourselves, yes, but also in our conflict partner, the one that we consider the other, we see how badly our two-ness illusion keeps us trapped and how we really do live in a oneness reality. It is very difficult to resolve a conflict without having, sometimes accidentally, stumbled into the reality of oneness. It is very difficult to resolve a conflict without escaping the constraints of our two-ness illusion. And that is true in our interpersonal relationships, and that is true in our national crisis of division. What shall we Christians do? We go to work on oneness. Now, what we don't do, and I want to reiterate this yet again, is we don't do more than we can do. I've spoken to several, both before and during this lesson, and when I ask them how this whole process is going for them, especially for the white folks that I ask, a recurring theme when it's adjusted for personalities and language differences is this. This thing scares my socks off. That's how it's going for me. When we pull back the curtain on our national division, when we pull back the curtain on how deep the roots go, how embedded in our national life racial inequity is, it feels overwhelming and it feels hopeless. It feels so big that we think there's nothing we can do about it. Now, we inherit an instinct as Americans, individualism on steroids. You know, historians call it rugged individualism. And the basic construct means that if it's going to be, it's up to me. That's kind of how we are weaned in our society. So we come to this instinct thinking, I've got to do something about this. I've got to take care of this thing. And it is so enormous. It becomes a load none of us can bear. When Jesus calls us to make right what has gone wrong, when Jesus calls us to make whole what has been torn and what has been damaged, it can feel overwhelming. So once again, I want to underscore what Jesus said the Christian way is when he said, look to the yeast, look to the mustard seed. No one of us is asked to do or to bear more than we can do or bear. We grow into our roles. We grow naturally. We grow over time. In the same way that our bodies grow, we grow into the roles that are set before us. When we do more, it's because we did little first. And when, Jesus taught us, we're faithful doing little, something expands inside of us, and more doesn't even feel like more. It's just a natural growth progression. That's how this kingdom of God thing works. Faithfulness with little things expands us. And in our expanded state, we are able to and we want to do more. In the things that we will do together in the years before us, none of us can do it all, and none of us can do it all at one time. That's not how this spiritual journey works. So, not that. Last week, we framed the answer to the question, what shall we do, using the role that religion plays in a society. You'll remember that. I said last week religion's role is to promote virtue and spirituality in its adherence, to challenge blind spots in its adherence, to challenge blind spots in the society, and then to advocate for the weak and the vulnerable. This is our job. This is our role. We looked at number one last week. Today, let's start with number two. Religion's role is to challenge blind spots in its adherence. Together, we work to challenge our own blind spots. That's a starting place for this issue on racial equity. Before we challenge anybody else's blindness, we take the log out of our own eye. That's what Jesus taught us. My hope for this fall lesson has been that it's helped us see together as a community things that we had not seen. We all inherit blind spots just by growing up where we grow up. There is no guilt in that. There is no shame in that. I grew up preferring street tacos to pimento cheese sandwiches. People who grew up here say, that's crazy. They've not had street tacos in Southern California. Our blind spots were determined by where we went to school. Our blind spots were determined by the TV we grew up on, the textbooks in our schools. There is no guilt in that. There's no shame in that. It's just what happens. But our Christian tradition teaches us that we do have a responsibility to push up against our inherited blind spots, to not let them rule us, to not normalize them, and especially not to integrate them into our religion and call them spiritual, or integrate them into our religion and call them the will of God or some other adulteration. Now, in the history section of this lesson, we saw the policies behind why we grow up insulated from one another. We saw why we grow up in different neighborhoods, different racial neighborhoods, different racial social circles, different racial religious circles. This insulation that we have one from another both creates blind spots and keeps them intact. Now, a few people mix it up across the divide, but in the main, our society creates layers of separation, layers that reinforce keeping our blind spots in place. So here's the thing. That being the case, When our religion calls us to push up against our blind spots, it's going to put us cross-grain to everyday American life. In other words, challenging our blind spots makes us work outside of accepted social norms. Our religion challenges us to venture into the spaces that everyday society keeps us out of. But interestingly, that's a pattern that has long been part of our Christian legacy. We've always been called to be countercultural because oneness has always been counterintuitive. Challenging our two-ness illusion has always been counterintuitive. So again, there's no condemnation in inheriting blind spots. We all have them, but we do have a mandate to begin to push against them. So two practical ways that we can do that. First, engage stories that we don't usually hear. And second, experience proximity that we don't usually experience. You've heard me say this many times. When we humans convey our most important truths, we tell stories. One of the best ways to challenge our blind spots is to engage stories that we don't usually hear. This is fundamentally different from how our society usually talks about race. Our society usually debates the issue of race. Our society usually recites facts about race and statistics about race. Our society usually configures those facts and those statistics in order to make a case, in order to make a point, and storytelling is not that. We engage stories in order to see something that we have not seen. Now, for a long time, I've been doing that. I've been engaging stories told by people of color, articles, books, podcasts, videos. I put a lot of them up here on our website on the page, the resource page, Rethinking Race. Now, if you go to those resources, and I really hope you do, you can approach those in case-making, fact-citing mode. Wait, that's a questionable fact. Wait, that's an unfair spin. Wait, what about this counterpoint that you left unsaid? We can do that. We usually do. But that's a temptation that we're very familiar with if we've gone through the conflict resolution training. If you go through conflict resolution training, you're always trying to make your point until you realize the importance of storytelling. But there's another way to approach stories. We can listen to understand. We can listen to see a perspective that is not our perspective. That's conflict resolution 101. It's a fundamentally different way of engaging those who fall into the category of other. Even when that one is a loved one, when they fall into the category of other, we have a pattern in our minds that we go to, and storytelling breaks that pattern. One of the best ways to challenge our blind spots is to engage stories that we don't usually hear. Listen beyond our rebuttals. Listen to understand. Now, for us as white people, we listen beyond our well-rehearsed societal objections. You know what they are. You hear them all the time. You hear them in every context that we've got. They're bred into us. And instead of mounting those objections and mounting those case-making points, we ask ourselves, what does that story tell me? What does that story tell me about what it's like or what it was like to be black in America? What does that story tell me about what it's like to be a black father? What does that story tell me what it's like to be a black mother or a black student or a black son or a black daughter? What does that story help me see that I would not normally see? Really appreciated this TED Talk when Angie posted it. I hope you've had a chance to listen to it on our Facebook group. It's a black man going undercover online, participating in a hyper-nationalist, white supremacist online groups. And his story demonstrates the kind of listening that we're talking about. He listened to understand. He listened to understand a story that was not his story, actually a story that was very offensive to him. But he listened to understand the thing under the thing. And again, that is the exact same process that we practice when we're doing conflict resolution. There's always part of the other's story that is not ours. There's always part of the other's story that is objectionable. But if we listen to understand, we become capable of accessing the thing that is under the thing. And when we can understand that, we can understand what drives our divisions. And when we understand that, we can understand what drives our ugly actions and our ugly reactions. And we can access the work that begins relationship making. Now, for a long time, I've been engaging racial stories that are not mine. And I started out with concepts in my head because I've know a lot of history and I've taken a lot of classes. But stories go much deeper than concepts go. Stories help us feel things that we hadn't felt. For me, stories put race into my emotional framework. Stories made race more oneness than two-ness for me. The experience of fear that someone else had became fear for me. The experience of overwhelm that someone else felt became overwhelm for me. Anger that was felt by another became anger for me. A couple of times over the course of these last few years, my reading has evoked tears. Once I felt physically ill. My wife will attest, here is rock solid, emotionally steady Doug. I don't feel feelings. I had to stop one video just because I couldn't contain my emotion. It was so painful. My story became informed by the whole story, not just my part as a white man. Stories have helped me see beyond my inherited blind spots. I got to experience more of the whole and be less limited to my part. But it's demanding. Only hearing part of the story protects us. If we only hear part of the story, we don't have to feel the fear, and we don't have to feel the overwhelm, and we don't have to feel the anger. And that's why we tend to stay in our blind spots. Because in the short run, they feel a whole lot better. When Denise and I would do this around conflict resolution, it was so much easier for me not to hear her story, because when I would hear her story, I would have to grapple with things that were rooted in my own fears. It's much more challenging to hear the whole story. In the short run, keeping our blind spots is better, but in the long run, it destroys us. When our religion is healthy, thank you, Rabbi. When our religion is healthy, it helps us. It helps us help one another challenge our blind spots. It helps us engage stories that society wants to keep from us. Our religion, when it's doing its best, encourages us. It bolsters one another's courage. It encourages us to see what is hard to see and to feel what is hard to feel. We challenge our blind spots when we engage stories that we don't typically hear. But even better than stories, we challenge our blind spots when we practice proximity, when we get near to people of other races. That's when our stories get told and are heard in a very personal way. Insights get shared. Two-ness blinders begin to fall away. We develop oneness eyes. Proximity practiced well can breed trust and affection and eventually love. And when love happens, our stories just naturally become intertwined in a web of oneness. Now, Jared's working on ways that we can do this together as a community. Soon, you will hear him start making announcements along those lines, but you don't have to wait. As soon as you see an opening, get together with someone of another race. Get to know someone of another race. Ask them for coffee. Look to the yeast. If a million of us do that, if a million of us become intertwined in one another's stories, our world changes. Now, Jared mentioned in an announcement a few weeks ago that he hopes to help us as a community develop an ongoing relationship with an African-American church to build relationships, to tell stories, to be mutually supportive, maybe collaborate on projects. And maybe you could help him. That's harder than it sounds. Maybe you could talk to him about helping with that process. But again, we don't have to wait until we are ready organizationally to do this together. We can look to practice proximity now. So some practical words about that if you do, and I hope you do. I've been doing proximity for a while. Now, the direct approach works for my personality. You'll have to find an approach that works for your personality, but directly, I will just tell you from experience, I might get a few wide eyes, but for the most part, this has worked very well for me. And what I do is this. I simply ask as many people of color as is socially appropriate to go to coffee. That's my approach. That's a little easier for me because I am a minister, and ministers are supposed to ask people to coffee. But as we're getting to know each other, I will ask pretty directly. Sometimes even before the coffee happens, I will ask. Now, I know something big is going on in our society, and I have a little bit of understanding, but I also live in my white person silo over here. And so I'm wondering if you'd be willing to tell me about your experience of X or Y or Z. Now, more recently, the thing that I've been asking about is this NFL kerfuffle that's going on. Before that, it was Ferguson. Before that, it was Baltimore. Then Eric Garner, maybe Black Lives Matter just in general. Now, I've done the same with police officers because aside from cop shows, I don't know the stories of police officers. I don't know how that goes. Now, I go direct, and one of the reasons that I can is because I have a pretty high tolerance for strong feelings. Because if we get past our social politeness, strong feelings do come up. There's a lot of ugliness in our nation's racial story. There's a lot of hurt that has happened in our nation's racial story. There's a lot of awfulness, and there's more than a little mistrust. And of course, there's anger. So I go in expecting strong feelings, prepared for the strong feelings when they emerge. And I go prepared to be okay with strong feelings. But that being said, I've been very fortunate. As soon as it's clear that I am okay with afflictive emotions, as soon as I don't react, as soon as I don't get defensive, as soon as I don't press my case, as soon as I don't, yeah, but, as soon as I make it clear that I really am there to hear more than to be heard, the people of color I've asked to tell me their stories have been over the top gracious to me. This is such a demanding ask. To ask people of color to carry the weight of explaining to me after they've already gone through that, it is such a demanding ask, and yet they have been over the top gracious, over the top transparent, over the top honoring of my curiosity. So again, I've been very fortunate. But I'll also tell you, it is not easy to push against social convention. It is not easy to hear painful stories. But again, we need this. If we're going to participate in healing the earth, we need our blind spots challenged. We need to find ourselves in a bigger story, the story of the whole of which our own life has only been a part. Now, I put up this slide about emotional intelligence at the very beginning of this lesson, the first week of this lesson, and I put that up, and what we're talking about right now, that's why. Because pushing against our blind spots is demanding of emotional intelligence. Emotional capacity is necessary if we're going to do this. If we are going to undertake this journey, we have to have emotional capacity. That's why religion's first role is to promote spirituality and virtue. Because spirituality and virtue translate into emotional capacity. That's why we help one another grow in our spiritual lives, in attaching to the divine and distancing ourselves from our false selves. We can't access ugly stories if our false self gets yanked in the hearing. We can't access blind spot challenging stories if we react defensively or if we experience a compulsive need to champion our cause. We can't accessed blind spot challenging stories if we need to be heard more than we are ready to hear. If we don't bring emotional intelligence, we simply won't hear the stories that will challenge our blind spots. All the same reactions that come up around racial division also come up whenever we do conflict resolution. It's the same thing. It's the same principles and practices. It's the same self-defensive strategy. It's the same my story is more important than your story. It's the same processes that you can't resolve a conflict with these principles in place. You certainly can't participate in this bigger picture of bringing wholeness to the racial divisions in our nation. When we are conflicted, the first thing that comes up is a protect my story strategy against my conflict partner. I'm pointing at her because she has regularly been my conflict partner. When we are conflicted, the same, yeah, but you did this other thing story comes up. The same otherizing narrative comes up in conflicts that comes up with our loved ones. Why wouldn't it come up around our national divide? If you've gone through the conflict resolution training, you know what I'm talking about. The moment we shift from defending our own story to actually hearing our conflict partner's story, that's when the magic happens. And this that we're talking about, this is that. It just happens in a bigger context. You also know, if you've done the conflict resolution training, as soon as we can make that shift, the conflict is as good as resolved. Everything after that is just mop-up. Negotiating a good outcome, that happens pretty easily once we can make that shift. Now, that's more challenging when it comes to race because we're not dealing person to person. We're dealing with a whole system of our society. But the same principle applies. When we have shifted from the defense of our own story so that we now are trying to solve the problem for the whole, not just solve the problem for the part, then we can actually see where to go, what needs to be done. That's religion's role, to help us push against our blind spots. And as a community, we have several tools to help us do that together. In the years ahead, you're going to hear recurring invitations to learn the conflict resolution process. Since we've already started this year's training, a few tips. If you get an opportunity to hear a story that you would not normally hear, come to listen. Do not come to defend. Come to listen for the thing unto the thing. Repeat back what you've heard. Repeat the other's stories using your own words. Doesn't mean that your story is invalid. It just ensures that you hear, that you truly hear and understand. And also try to feel. Try to feel what their story feels like. Imagine what it would be like to live that story. Now, that is not the way our social interactions go, but it is how things go if we want to challenge our blind spots. We learn to listen to understand. Now, if you're not doing the conflict resolution training this year, there are a couple of pages on our website that will help you. One is called Self-Awareness, Self-Disclosure. The other, Conflict Resolution, do the first one first. They'll both take you about an hour to work your way through, and you will realize that there's a whole process, a whole construct there that will help you learn how to have these kinds of blind spot challenging conversations. So, as religious people, our role in society, we develop our own spirituality, we awaken to the divine life, we challenge our own false selves, and then we see what we have not seen, we push up against, challenge our blind spots. And as we do that, it becomes possible then to challenge the blind spots in our society as well. We can only speak with authority about things that we have experienced personally. We can only describe unseen things if we've actually seen them. So for most of us, when we go to the process of blind spot challenging, it's more likely going to involve a cup of coffee than it is a soapbox. But even so, if it's just speaking to someone over a cup of coffee, it will still be a courageous act. Because there is a lot of pressure in our society not to talk about race. You are probably feeling that pressure just sitting there right now. Even though we will have those conversations with our own people inside of our own silo, within our own in-group, there is still a lot of social pressure not to have them, to keep the hidden things hidden. There's a lot of social pressure to keep the invisible things invisible. Our religious role to challenge the blind spots of our society goes completely cross-grain to social convention. It will be daunting to have these conversations, even over coffee, even within our own silo. Pushing against the blind spots of the folks in our circle is difficult. And why do all that difficult work, when it feels so powerless, when it feels so impotent? I mean, all I'm doing is having coffee with somebody. Well, we all grew up on mass media instincts. Interestingly, Jesus did not function with mass media instincts. We were weaned on the power of television ads to change an election. we were weaned on the power of celebrity to grab our collective attention. We were weaned on the power of the New York book list to define a social conversation. We were weaned on mass media concepts, and interestingly, Jesus was not. So when we think about influence, when we think about challenging the blind spots in the society around us, we tend to think in mass media terms. So even when you just have a Facebook account, even when you just make a Facebook post, the question in the back of our minds is, how many likes will I get? We start thinking about how many people will read this. We start wondering, how big will the audience be? That comes from a construct in which Jesus did not function. Jesus told us, again, look to the yeast. Jesus told us, again, look to the mustard seed. Look for change that happens more one-to-one than one-to-audience. But we were weaned in a culture that practically only values one to an audience. That is not the way of Jesus. I showed this slide a couple of years ago. It describes the way of the yeast. It describes the way of the mustard seed. It's Goodwin's informality theorem. Pick that up in some class somewhere. It says that the degree of influence is inversely proportional to how formal, how structured the influence is. In other words, we influence a little bit through big media, but we influence a lot over a cup of coffee. One may influence a million people, but not very much. The other will only influence one, but that influence is engaged much more deeply. So you might have a social megaphone. Maybe you have a say in your company's hiring practices. Maybe you can influence policy at your kid's school. Maybe you get to determine what real estate gets shown to whom. And if that's the case, our religion charges us all to use that influence wisely. But for most, influence will be practiced best with coffee in hand. We tell our own stories. We tell about what happened to us. That's what we can speak about authoritatively. We tell about what we have seen that we had not seen. We tell about what we have read or what we watched or what we heard that we had not seen. We tell the story of what happened when we practice proximity, when we hear stories that we hadn't heard. We challenge blind spots when we tell people our story, when we tell our people our story. People who live in that same silo we live in. People whose society gives them the same blind spots that we inherited. That's how the yeast model goes. We help one another grow in virtue and spirituality. We help one another challenge our own blind spots. And then we tell our story. We tell our story of growth. We tell our story of seeing what we had not seen. We talk about what we're experiencing. And we challenge our society's blind spots, one story at a time. And finally, our role as a religion is to advocate for the weak and the vulnerable. Since rethinking Christianity and rethinking church has been such a critical part of our community life together, as we've been developing our approach to the service quadrant of working the circle, we've been very careful to spend a lot of time discerning before we started acting. So for the teams that have been working on these things, they've been listening for the inner nudges about this way, not that way, this thing, not that thing, and that's been really important. And as we've been doing this discerning, one of the first themes to emerge in the process is empowering, not enabling. In other words, learn from the mistakes of the past. Don't bring unconscious arrogance to the work. Don't assume we know. Don't assume we will lead. Work collaborative. Work relationally, not hierarchically. Don't create dependency. Don't steal dignity. Empower others. And because we're in relationship, be empowered in turn. That was criteria number one. You should ask the neighbor serve about that process team. If you're on the neighbor serve, just wave your hand. So talk to those folks about that process. Criteria number two has been to consider race seriously. To consider seriously our nation's original sin. Though it is an illusion, it's a powerful illusion. It's a persistent illusion. In the years before us, Jared, helping to lead up the Neighbor Serve team, is going to invite us to a list of projects in which we can participate. When we support the food bank, we aren't working on race, we're working on food insecurity. But we are not unaware that because of the historical factors that we've explored in this lesson, per capita, more people of color suffer food insecurity. When we support Family Promise, we're not working on race. We're supporting a 2-year process that moves families from homelessness to economic viability. But we are not unaware that because of the historical factors that we've explored in this lesson, per capita, people of color suffer more homelessness. When we're working on the things that we explored yesterday in the Restorative Justice Conference, when we're working on the school-to-prison pipeline or helping restore victims of violent crime, we're not working on race. We're bringing love to suffering. We're working on restoring what has been broken. But we are not aware that because of the historical factors we've explored in this lesson, per capita, more people of color face these challenges. In the years before us, we'll circle back again and again to these long-standing projects. New projects will emerge over time following the same principles, projects that consider race in how we bring healing to the earth. Again and again, year after year, we will invite one another to engage the Servant Squadrant, repairing the earth, restoring what's been broken, healing what's been wounded. And we will do so informed by the deep wounds of our nation's original sin, working to mitigate the effects of racial inequity in our nation, working to heal our own lives as we work to heal our nation. And yet again, not this. Now, I hope you've noticed the progressive nature of the 4 roles that religion plays. A progression that our community is going to follow in the years before us because each step readies us for the next. We get ready for the next step because that readiness is baked right into 1, 2, 3, and 4. Spirituality challenges the false self. And having our false self challenged readies us to challenge our blind spots. Challenging our blind spots readies us to tell our story to other people. Stories that challenge our shared blind spots together. And telling that story roots change more deeply in our own souls, and that readies us for sustainable work advocating for others. When religion is at its best, it provides a framework for this process to unfold in our lives. When religion is at its best, it provides support for one another to go through the 4 stages of this role of religion in our society and in our own lives. When religion is at its best, we help one another through the process, each at our own pace, nobody forcing anything down anybody's throat. But we are regularly invited to take up the path that Jesus set before us. That's what you can expect in the years before us as a community. Gentle but persistent invitations to take up the role of religion, to take up the role and discern our bit, your bit, healing the wounds that have been caused by our nation's original sin. And I pray that it may be so in our community. Lord, may we be agents of healing in our nation. Amen.